Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to this week's edition of Booker T. Washington Speaks, our internet and telephonic radio family room discussion. At this time, I, Marshall Washington Cabinus, the host and moderator, would like to turn the mic over to my co-host, Mr. Halim Mustafa. Mr. Mustafa, you've got the mic.
Excellent. Good evening, everyone. Again, welcome to Book Discussion Speak. Today is Saturday, July 29th, 2017. Halim Mustafa, your co-host, joining you from Houston, Texas, along with our globally distinguished host and moderator, Professor Marshall Washington, who is the senior great-grandson of Dr. Booker T. Washington, founder of Tuskegee University in Alabama. We both join you from our virtual family living room as we sit around a warm fireplace and sipping our favorite alcohol-free refreshment so we can have a sober conversation on tonight's topic. The topic tonight is, do African-American children need to be required to read African-American literature in school? Again, as your co-host, Halim, We expect to have some astute members of the Modern Day Achievers to join this discussion at some point, so we'll look forward to them. And again, joining me this evening is Imam Musa Abui, who is our honorable and distinguished host and visionary for this Blog Talk Radio, Booker T. Washington Speaks. So as part of our effort, we like to begin opening in prayer. But before I say that, let me say this. There's a book that's been written that you need to be familiar with, a very, very hot commodity, and it's written by our distinguished host on his great-grandfather, Booker T. Washington, and the title of the book is Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, and I strongly recommend that our listening audience around the world order you a copy of this very informative historical book so we all can become leaders like his great-grandfather in the fight to overcome the effects of American slavery in the 21st century. through the professor's eyes, you will be inspired with a new insight on what it means to be black and free, regardless of color and cultural differences. So in the tradition, I'd like to begin with prayer, so just be with me for a moment. With the name of God, Allah, our sole universal creator, most gracious, most merciful, praise be to our creator, the cherisher and sustainer of all the worlds throughout the universe, seen and unseen, most gracious, most merciful, master of the day of judgment. Thee alone do we worship, and thy aid, guidance, and protection we seek. Show us the straight way, the way of those whom thou hast bestowed thy grace, those whose portion is not wrath and who go not astray in their duty to humanity. Amen. Let it be so. Now, without any further ado, I'd like to bring on our distinguished host and visionary of this project, and here he is, the professor.
Thank you, Brother Haleem Mustafa, and I hope that everyone is having a good Saturday evening on this end of July weekend. The year seems to be just rushing by, and the school year here in Georgia actually begins on Monday. And so here we are now starting another academic year and another opportunity for literally millions of children to continue their formal education in the classroom. And so we've chosen the topic for this evening, the question, do African-American children need to become acquainted with African-American literature in school? And I think that's very, very important that we discuss this question in our family room forum this evening, because the truth of the matter is that many African-American children are going to enter the classroom, the first grade classroom anyway, for the first time this week. And for the next 8-9 years, they will do much reading. But the question is whether or not they will be reading about themselves. The question is whether or not they'll be reading about their grandparents and great-grandparents, their family members, either in a direct sense or in an indirect sense. And this is important, because if these children proceed through school and they don't get any knowledge of the past history of their own people, they're going to have a warped idea of who they are and who they can be. So I want to begin by reading a very famous piece by a gentleman who had many, many roles during his lifetime. He was a lawyer, he was a political civil rights activist, and he was also a songwriter and a poet, and his name was James Weldon Johnson. Many of you may be familiar with this particular poem as it's sung as the Black National Anthem, or as we may say today, the African-American National Anthem. So I'm just going to share the words just to set the tone for our discussion. We want to thank everyone who has joined us this evening. I see we have quite a few callers, and we are going to shorten our talk so that you can have an opportunity to give us your views on the question. And I will repeat the question. Do African-American children need to become acquainted with African-American literature in school? Having repeated the question, let me just share some of that literature with you right now. This is the poem that is also the lyrics for the song, Lift Every Voice and Sing. I'm just going to read it. I'm not going to sing it. By James Weldon Johnson. Lift every voice and sing, till earth and heaven ring, ring with the harmonies of liberty. Let our rejoicing rise high as the listening skies. Let it resound loud as the rolling sea. Sing a song full of the faith that the dark past has taught us. Sing a song full of the hope that the present has brought us, facing the rising sun of our new day begun, let us march on till victory is won. Stony the road we trod, bitter the chastening rod, felt in the days when hope unborn had died, with a steady beat, have not our weary feet come to the place for which our fathers sighed? We have come over a way that with tears has been watered. We have come, treading our path through the blood of the slaughtered, out from the gloomy past, till now we stand at last where the white gleam of our bright star is cast. God of our weary years, God of our silent tears, thou who has brought us thus far on the way, thou who has by thy might led us into the light, keep us forever on in the path we pray, lest our feet stray from the places, our God, where we met thee, lest our hearts, drunk with the wine of the world, we forget thee. Shadowed beneath thy hand, may we forever stand, true to our God, true to our native land. A very appropriate poem for the time that we are living in today, as it was back in the early 1900s when it was written, and it's still being sung at many assemblies, and actually even assemblies of mixed races of people. And that's wonderful, because these sentiments can be shared by all people, even though James Weldon Johnson was particularly talking about the African-American people. But many people can actually relate to this. And the question is, since this is a what we would call black literature piece or African-American literature piece, is this something that needs to be shared with the students by the teachers in the elementary schools or the high schools? Now, before I leave and turn it over to our callers, I want to share something with you from a book that is very dear and near to me. The book is titled Up From Slavery, and it's the autobiography of a distinguished member of my own family, Booker T. Washington, who was my great-grandfather on my mother's side. Booker T. Washington was my mother's grandfather. And when I was about 8 years old, maybe 9 years old, my grandmother, Booker T. Washington's daughter-in-law, put the book in my hand, not this exact copy, of course, but a copy of the book Up From Slavery. And she said, "You must read this. You must read this. It's very, very important that you understand where you came from, and you must understand the work that your great-grandfather did so you can aspire to emulate that work." And so I'm just going to read a paragraph or so from this book, Up From Slavery. It's taken from the chapter Boyhood Days. Now, remember, I was a boy. I was only 8 or 9 years old when I read this book. And this paragraph says this. In those days, he's talking about when he was a child of about 12 or 13 years old. He says, in those days, and later as a young man, I used to try to picture in my imagination the feelings and ambitions of a white boy with absolutely no limit placed upon his aspirations and activities. I used to envy the white boy who had no obstacles placed in the way of his becoming a congressman, governor, bishop, or president by reason of the accident of his birth or race. And this can apply to girls as well. I used to picture the way that I would act under such circumstances, how I would begin at the bottom and keep rising until I reached the highest rung, highest round of success. In later years, I confess that I do not envy the white boy as I once did. I have learned that success is to be measured not so much by the position that one has reached in life as by the obstacles which he has overcome while trying to succeed. Looked at from this standpoint, I almost reached the conclusion that often the Negro boy's birth and connection with an unpopular race is an advantage so far as real life is concerned. With few exceptions, the Negro youth must work harder and must perform his task or her task even better than a white youth in order to secure recognition. But out of the hard and unusual struggle through which he or she is compelled to pass, he or she gets a strength and a confidence that one misses, whose pathway is comparatively smooth by reason of birth and race. From any point of view, I had rather be what I am, a member of the Negro race, than be able to claim membership with the most favored of any other race. And I wanted to read that because that's profound when you think that these young people today have to claim something that they stand upon to be proud of in terms of who they are, where they came from, what their background is, what their heritage is. This is important. It's very important. And you know, I've traveled throughout the world, and I've been in Europe, and I've been in South America, I've been in Asia, I've been in Africa, I've been in Arabia. And one thing that I noticed everywhere I go is that people continue to define themselves by the past work and the past achievements of their ancestors. And yet the African-American child, if he's not given this in school, because many of the parents may not have access to all of this information, they may not have libraries even in their home to acquaint them with books like Up From Slavery. So if they're not given this in the schools, then they're not going to get it, and that's going to handicap them greatly and deprive them of a sense of strength that I was able to have when my grandmother put this book in my hand many, many years ago. So having said that, I'm going to open up the mic, and I see we have a number of callers, but before I invite our callers, I want to give our co-host a chance to respond briefly, and then we'll go ahead and continue to invite our callers to come online with your response. So, Brother Halim Mustafa, would you like to respond to what we've said in our opening statement?
Yes, most definitely, most definitely. And one thing I want to reference, the home of our native land, that's really important, and that is an inclusive statement, home of our native land. So American history has to be more inclusive based on truth and not on what is called social privilege of people who are making themselves look like they created everything, including the air and the sun and the moon, right? So the obstacles overcome by those at the bottom of the economic and career pathway food chain has to become important. And having the legacy of the cultural history is very important to everyone. So being disconnected from our culture in America and around the world has caused us to be really, really subtly and sometimes obviously inferior. And that is something we have to take out of this American ideal and dream and what the intention of the forefathers of this country, in terms of all men were created equal, we have to make it real. That's my comments right now. Professor, that's my comments right now, but I'll continue if you like me to.
Hey, I'm back, and I just wanted to say thank you very much. We certainly appreciate your wisdom and your contribution over the last few months to making this show a great success. For those of you that may not know it, this show is actually broadcast globally. There are people all over the world that have access to the internet that are able to tune in and hear this family room discussion, because even though the focus in our family room is the African-American family, in truth, our family is our global family. So we invite all people who have the opportunity to come on to this program, either by telephoning in or by listening on the internet, to join with us in our family room discussion to share your thoughts, because these things, even though we may specifically be talking about African American history, I find in my travels that many of the things that we talk about as being problems or challenges that we have to overcome are common to humanity. So we want to make that very clear. And so now we want to open up our mic. We have a caller who I believe is one of the early callers that came online on the telephone from the area code 346. And the last two digits of your phone number are 35. We'd like to invite you to come on, and everyone else, please be patient, because we're asking everybody just to begin by making some brief comments so we can go around the table, so to speak, and everybody gets a chance to introduce what they would like to say, and then we'll go back around. Here you go. This is for our 346 area code caller, and we're bringing you on the mic. Please go ahead. Our 346 area code caller from the phone number, the last two digits of your number are 35. Would you like to go ahead and join us now with the comment?
Have enough. This is Catherine, a modern day achiever. I'd like to really emphasize on what Dr. Haleem Mustafa was mentioning, just how everything slavery and everything has to come up to recognition, and we have to come to know what our ancestors went through, because it's very important, I feel, so that we can move forward. And yeah, that's pretty much my comment.
Okay, well, thank you so much. We are very, very happy that you were able to join us tonight, and I hope that as we go through our discussion, you may have other comments that you want to make. And so I'm going to go ahead and move on now, and then we'll come back to you, and we're going to come back to your mentor, Dr. Haleem Mustafa, the co-host. But now we want to ask our caller from the 706 area code, the last two numbers of your phone number are 36, and I believe I know who this is, but we want to invite you to come on now and give us your comments. And your number is 706, and I won't read the whole number, but I want to give you some privacy here, but the last two numbers of your phone number are 36. Would you like to speak to us now? Okay, I suppose you may not be ready to come on and speak. We'll just watch, and we'll come back to you in just a few minutes. Okay, well, I'd like to ask our brother Haleem Mustafa to go ahead and respond to what your modern day achiever mentee just said. I'm sure that you've talked about some of these issues maybe today, maybe before, and we want to give you a chance to go ahead and offer your support to your mentee. We all appreciate her being here and coming on tonight. So, Dr. Haleem Mustafa, let me go ahead and put the mic on. Okay, you've got the mic.
Yes. Excellent. Good evening, and Catherine Martinez, we say is a Karen Catherine. You are a very unique individual, and she's 18 years old and very mature in her growth here in America, being born in Honduras. But the point is that she is very profound in thinking and very supportive in terms of how to get people to work together, and that's critical. So she reflects the attitude that we are building in the young people we call modern-day achievers. So there's more to be said, but in the future, she is one, definitely a leader that will be standing strong. And I don't believe a politician, maybe the president of America. Let's say that, okay? So I'm going to wait and just let things go. Welcome.
Well, that's wonderful. Yes, Catherine, did you want to say something? I'll put you back on.
Thank you. I appreciate you for having me.
Oh, well, wonderful. We're certainly honored, actually, very honored to have you. I was just going to say that I remember when I was 18 years old, it seems like a lifetime ago, in a way I suppose it was, because we're talking about something that happened many, many, many years ago. But the fact is that the world was very, very exciting to me, as it still is. And my challenge was to prove myself to my family, but also to develop something that was inside of me, which was a desire to serve my country. I had growing up at Tuskegee, I remember many, many times standing in front of the flag at the Catholic school that I attended, saying the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag with my hand placed over my heart. I remember seeing parades on the campus of Tuskegee with the military program cadets in their uniforms marching behind the American flag with the band preceding them playing a marching beat. And they were so proud and erect. And I was so happy to believe that one day I could do that. And in time, I was able to do the same thing. And I served in our nation's armed forces for a total of 30 years and marched in many, many military parades. So we want to make sure that everyone understands that even though our people were not what we would say volunteers for the trip to come to America, we have come and we have stayed and we will stay. And our choice now is to develop a real identity as being part of the United States body of successful citizens, You know, it was many, many years before we could even call ourselves citizens. For over 250 years, we weren't considered citizens at all. And then the 14th Amendment was passed right after the Civil War, and we were called citizens, but in many places we didn't have the rights of citizens. We were able to be counted by the politicians and the voting population so that they could go among us and ask us to go to the polls and vote for them, but we really had no real citizenship rights. In many cases, we couldn't vote after the laws, the grandfather clauses and Jim Crow voting laws were passed. And I remember, and I'll never forget, and I hate to put a damper on this conversation, but it's worth saying, that one of my childhood friends who was very, very interested in real citizenship for African-American people went down to the courthouse with some people that he had loaded in his little Volkswagen. He could only put about three or four people in there, crammed in there. And he took them down to the courthouse and said that these people are citizens and they want to vote. And the people in the courthouse said, well, I don't know what you're talking about. They're not really able to vote. They don't have the rights to vote. And he gave his life working to help these people earn, in the eyes of those people in the courthouse, the right to vote. Now, I say this because our young people may grow up not feeling it's important to participate in the electoral process in their neighborhoods, in their cities, states, and in the nation. And the reason why is because they may, like so many people in the past, feel that they don't really belong. But trust me, we belong. And as I've traveled many, many times through the South on the two-lane highways, you don't see these beautiful old homes from the freeways, the interstate, but you see them still standing sometimes when you go on the two-lane highways, beautiful, beautiful mansions that actually set the character of the old South. We built those. We, the black people, actually were the ones that built those. And oftentimes the people that owned the plantations would take black servants with them when they would travel to Europe or travel throughout other parts of the country. And they would have these servants study those homes and draw plans, go inside and look at the floor layout and look at the outside design, and they would draw plans, and then when they got back, they would get with a group of other skilled black people, and they would duplicate these homes, and they're still all over the South. So we have a real interest in this country. We may have been forced to do it. Many of our people may not have even liked the work, but the fact is that we did the work, and we did it well. And so our challenge now is to teach our young people the good history and some of it may not be good, but the history of our people as we developed strength and character and skills growing up here in America, sometimes in slavery, sometimes in freedom. And if we don't teach them that, they're going to be lost. And we see that happening today all over America in the cities and maybe even in the rural areas. We see our young people walking around looking like they're lost. And part of the reason is because, unlike when I was a child, nobody's put in a book in their hand like my grandmother put in my hand, saying I don't have to be ashamed of who I am, because a person's real worth is not judged by his color or her color, but by the obstacles that they have to overcome to achieve the things that they seek. So having said that, I want to go back and I want to ask our caller from the 706 area code, 706, I'm going to give you a little more help here. Last three digits of your phone number are 336. Would you like to share some thoughts with us right now? All right. Oftentimes we do have listeners who just want to listen. Maybe later you might want to chime in. This is a family room discussion, but everybody doesn't have to discuss by making statements. You can discuss this by taking in the information, and maybe in another conversation offline, you may want to share some of these thoughts with some of your family members and your friends. And so I want to go back now to our co-host, Brother Khalid Mustafa, and I want to ask you a specific question. And this is not to put you on the spot, but did you know that...
I feel like a really man. I'm so sorry. I was trying to switch over, and my phone was acting a little crazy for whatever reason. But I was trying to switch over, but I was a little fatigued, I guess. I think that it's important that we teach our children to read our own history, and I think it's important that we write our own history, because we can't expect other people to teach what they don't know and what's not important to them. It's important for our children to be taught cultural awareness and diversity. Children are uninhibited where after you become an adult, you don't just ask questions out loud, you know, you tend to just keep it to yourself, or with children will just say, well, why is that person behaving like that? Or why does that person look like that? Or, you know, children know differences in race and family composition and a multitude of other factors. But I think it's important that we teach them to read about our own history, pass it down. Even if they don't read, we should have somebody in our family that can sit down and orally talk to the children about the history of our people, and so that they have meaningful information about anthropology, history, or religion. Even on geography, where did your mother come from? Where did your father come from? In the context of their race and culture, religion, the language, we can't expect other people to familiarize our children with our culture. So as a means of passing on our culture, yes, I think we need to have our children read our history and to help them make sense of their own lives, of their own world, and to respect differences and similarities with other people as well. I think that's about all I have to say about that right now. Did everybody get the, did you hear me, really, ma'am?
I did hear you, and thank you. Thank you very, very much. I want to share something. And then I'm going to ask for comments from our other guests. But I'm a professor of history here in Georgia, and I teach U.S. history and also world history. And I'm looking at the standards for the high schools, which is where many students are going to get their real strong foundation to prepare them for the required course or courses in college history. And I won't go over this long list of specific standards, but as I page through what I'm looking at on the internet, I don't see anything at all that talks about our history, the African American people's history. But there is one thing that they do have as a standard, and it is very clear. It says, explain every citizen's right to be treated equally under the law. Now, on the surface, that's very simplistic. One would think that that would be easy to understand. But if a child lives in a segregated world where all of the nice opportunities for recreation, for clubs, for athletics, parks, and swimming pools exist, and in that person's mind, everybody has these same opportunities. But, you know, I grew up in an environment where we didn't even know that there were parks on the other side of town until later when the walls of segregation came down. We didn't even know that there was a nice outdoor swimming pool on the other side of town. So if students don't realize that, they may not have any knowledge of what equality really is, because they don't see what the other people have and what they've been deprived of. And this deprivation is still going on today. I travel across the country, and I go to schools that are mixed schools. I haven't been to any that are 100% white schools, but I've been to some that are about 70% white. And I've spoken about Booker T. Washington and received very, very, very loud applause, very cheerful, enthusiastic responses. But the fact is that in almost every case, when I go to the all-black schools, I see conditions that are very, very sad. I see old buildings. But, you know, the thing about it is I see people working. I see janitorial workers trying their best to keep those old floors shiny, to keep those bathrooms clean, to keep those fixtures in the bathrooms in good repair against odds, because these people are not getting the same equal treatment from the state. In most cases, they're not getting the same monies that the more affluent, predominantly white schools are getting. But yet they're trying. But if you tell this student that he or she should learn about all citizens being treated equally, you've got to bring them up to a level of equality. And if they have no idea what that is, they may learn to get used to having substandard accommodations. And we need to at least explain to them not so much about the reality of segregation, but of the reality of overcoming the challenges of having been segregated. And so I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to our speaker now from the 346 area code, our young friend, 18-year-old friend, because you have a very, very intelligent and precise outlook on some of these things. So would you like to share your thoughts with us again? That's our speaker, the young lady who is a member of the Modern Day Achievers. I think her name is it Catherine? From
Yes, Catherine.
Catherine, would you like to say more?
Yes, I apologize. I just had disruptions in the background. Yes. Something just came into mind. Really just to relate, you know, and not feel loneliness as a person of color. Too many things just go back to the white man, you know? And sometimes just to relate to another person of color, really, would be, I feel it would spark a lot of thought into going more deeper and deeper and deeper into knowing our truth. So that's my comment.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much. Yes, go ahead.
I wanted to say something to the young lady. I'm just curious. Some events have been taking place. I noticed that young people are very attached to cyberspace, so much so that I don't think that they're in the reality. I think that they're like that. They're like lost in cyberspace. They're disconnected as human beings from other human beings, and their socialization now is all about cyberspace and the cell phone. For example, an 18-year-old is driving a car. She's drinking. A 14-year-old sister is riding in the car with her, and she's videotaping her while she's driving, and she's driving erratic. And the 14-year-old saying to her, "You know, stop driving like this. You're gonna hurt us." Blah blah. So she's videotaping her 14-year-old sister at the same time she's driving, and the young girl says, "My sister's going to kill me because she's drinking and she's driving." And sure enough, the girl crashes into something. The sister gets, the 14-year-old gets thrown out of the car. She's lying on the ground, and her sister's standing there videotaping her and talking on the cell phone. "Oh, she fell out. Oh, we had an accident. Oh, she's dying. Oh, she died." So it seems like, it's Catherine, is there some kind of, am I missing? What is, I don't understand that kind of behavior. I'm observing this. It's some kind of disconnect, even though I'm not understanding. How are we going to connect them to our history and our culture when young people your age seem to be lost in cyberspace? They're not able to communicate any other way with other people as human beings except through the cell phone and social media. Or am I right? Is that what's going on?
I agree. It mostly comes down to getting lost in the internet and creating a persona of just a life that is not yours, and just making things, exaggerating them to get the likes, get the comments, get the followers. Really anything that could go viral. I feel so whenever you're just I feel so lost in the internet that it literally becomes your reality, because we're on the phone constantly.
That's a disconnect from being a human being. So you have become the cyberspace entity now. Am I right?
I agree. Yes.
So how are you going to share culture with somebody who's caught up in that? That's a whole 21st century. That's a 21st century.
Right. It's an entire dissociation with just even your body, your mind, because you're over here trying to convey a story or something dramatic to,
and if it's
again,
not something
to
that's going to go viral, if it's not something that's going to go viral, they don't want to hear it, right?
Right.
They don't want to be involved in it. They don't want to hear it. It's boring. It's boring to them. So me talking about my great grandmother was my grandmother was so many years old. She was telling me the history about how somebody in my family was hung by the European Americans, and they don't want to hear that. That's not gonna go viral. How am I gonna communicate with someone like that, Catherine? How am I gonna pass on my history to them? How would you go about passing on our culture to people who are lost in cyberspace?
It's a very, very interesting question because,
this is your reality. You're a 21st century person, right?
They're not even willing to listen.
Right.
To these important things because it just doesn't matter. It's not part of.
It's a disconnect there. There's a disconnect. They're not in the reality. They're not living. They're in the reality, but it's I think people like myself, Imam Musa, people who are in their 50s and 60s or 40s and I guess 40s, 50s, and 60s, they have no idea that your generation. Well, I'm aware of it, but they have no idea that your generation has become an extension of cyberspace, and that's why they're so attached to their cell phones or their iPads or the iPhone or the computer. And if you take these things away from your generation, they will lose their mind. Am I right?
Yes, I agree. It's more of a safe space, I would say, because it's an identity that you're making, that an identity that you're in charge of, if that makes sense, that you're completely in charge of. But I agree, it's just the big dissociation with our mind.
How
did this happen, Imam? How did this happen without parents and educators being aware? Well, I'm an educator. I'm aware. I'm aware that this has happened. And I'm aware and I understand why, even in the classroom, there's a disconnect because of the cyberspace now. It's on so many different levels. It's just mind-boggling to me.
Let me just interrupt. Not interrupt. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to say it like that. But let me just interject something. I think that Brother Haleem, as we know him to be, the doctor of self-esteem, Dr. Haleem Mustafa, since he has made a life's mission of working with young people, middle school and high school and college-age students, and, of course, I met him back in 2001, where I was very impressed with his commitment and the work that he has been doing for many years, working with young people, and I think he might be much more qualified to answer your question, Sister Baena. So, Brother Haleem, what would you have to say to answer or attempt to answer her question?
Yes, thank you for the talk. Catherine is very being modest. We had a conversation today regarding that same specific topic in terms of is the problem with the Z, like Z, A through Z, the Z generation, right? And we discussed this in terms of how to use the identity as the Z generation being identified as modern day achievers. And under that title, there becomes a responsibility of what is called patriotic duty. And that patriotic duty comes in many forms outside of just being technology driven and being on what we call the dumb thumb mode of just playing on the whatever the communication text and the phone activities entail. So the identity that Catherine mentioned is critical as modern-day achievers tied to a social responsibility, and the main things that these young people want is opportunity to make money and not just have social activity. But we as a society keep missing that point and only want to keep them in the social realm, but in the reality, these young people have need for money, resources, and we got to figure out how to make that connection. Modern day achievers is making that connection and tying the responsibility on them to be who they are as the Z generation and they are going, I believe, to be the most extraordinary ones that are going to lead this country back into a sober state of mind, these young people, because their understanding of what is the new method of communication, and a lot of us elders, I'm 62, and I'm not really technology, so driven that I understand it as a professional text writer or social media applications, but these young people do. We just have to empower them and unleash them and let them do what they do under the idea of an identity, which we call modern day achievers.
Well, thank you. Let me just interject something too, Brother Mustafa. Did you complete your statement?
Yes, I'm finished. Yes.
Oh, okay. Let me just say something right quick before you jump back in, Sister. You know, I work with Generation Z students every single day, both in the classroom and in my office in the academic building, as well as online with young people that I teach. And one of the things that I have learned is that as older, and I do say older, teachers, we have to learn to adapt ourselves to the learning styles of the people we're trying to teach. I learned a long, long, long time ago that if the student fails to learn, it's because the teacher has failed to teach. Now, there may be some people that need a certain kind of extra motivation. Back in the old days in the Catholic schools, which I didn't agree with this, I'm just saying this was the case, the extra motivation was an 18-inch ruler that the teacher, the nun, would use to inflict physical pain on your knuckles if you did not mind yourself in the classroom or if you had not done your homework or whatever you were supposed to be doing. I don't agree with that. I saw it happen many times. It probably happened to me once or twice. But the fact is that these nuns got results. They got very, very satisfactory results. Now, the children today are not going to go for that. So we as teachers, and remember, you know, even though some of the students that I have in the classroom with me may be in college, some of them are only 16 and 17 years old because in Georgia they have a dual enrollment program by which seniors in high school can become at the same time freshmen or even sophomores in college. I was a senior in high school when I was 16 years old. And so it's not unusual now to see 16-year-olds that are in college classrooms taking classes for credit. The point is that as teachers, as professors, we can't do what the nuns did to the students in the schools when I was a child.
No.
We have to come up with inventive ways to appeal to the students' needs in terms of their own learning styles. So let me just close by saying this. One of the challenges that I face when I'm teaching in the classroom, in the physical classroom, is that the students almost all have smartphones, and they love to text. I think many of them love to text more than they love to talk on the phone.
Yeah.
Which is really strange to me because it seems that it's a lot easier to talk on the phone than it is to text. But you'll see them and they're doing the thumb texting. They'll be in the elevators,
right.
They'll be in the classrooms, and to give a lecture and to try to keep those students' attention is really a big challenge. But the fact is that that's where they are. We're not going to change it. And I think that's what we are forced to realize as teachers and as professors. We are not going to change. These people are going to rule the world in the next 20 years. We're not going to change them. Let me finish, please. I'm going to block you if you don't let me finish. Let me say this. We are going to have to learn how to get to the core of what their needs are so we can at least be able to guide them away from the things that are self-destructive. Now, students spending all 50 minutes in the classroom texting their friends or whoever, about some thing that may have nothing to do with academic achievement, in a way is destroying their future academically. So we have to learn how to do something to make that classroom experience so fascinating, so interesting,
yes,
that that student will put that smartphone down and get involved in what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
That's the challenge that
mm-hmm.
we have. So let me just go ahead and say that. I didn't mean to be rude, but I did want to make that point. So, Sister Raina, please go ahead.
I certainly agree. But this is what I was trying to bring out while I was talking to Catherine, because the disconnect that I'm talking about, they're in cyberspace, and they're so much more technologically advanced than we are. We're still trying to catch up to where they are. So in a way, the educators today are hindering them from being where they need to be, because we're not allowing, the school system is not set up to allow them to explore this new technology, this 21st century age that we're in. They're inhibited in the classroom. We're inhibited because we're not on the level that they're on technologically. Okay, so they're in cyberspace, and to me, I'm saying to myself, how are we going to figure out how to teach this child moral responsibility? How are we going to teach this social skills? How do the social skills apply to a person who's connected to a cell phone or an iPhone or an iPad, when a man is drowning in a lake and this person is attached to their phone? They see the person drowning, but they're so disconnected. I don't know. I'm lost in space. I'm lost in cyberspace.
But let me ask our brother host. We're going to close in a few minutes. This program is going to stop in about 5 to 10 minutes. I was waiting to see if we had additional callers so everybody would have a chance to make a comment. But we're going to stop in a few minutes. But I want to ask our host, Brother Eileen, well, you work with young people every day. What is your opinion in terms of how we can allow them to develop based on their skill sets in the technological arena and still be adults in the room, so to speak? Well, what is your opinion?
From what I have been experiencing with them as we're growing, the opportunities that they participate in planning, which become like business opportunities, real income earning opportunities with incentives tied to performance and conduct of, say, what is a good image for the peers that they represent. We are addressing it from that perspective, and it gives them the incentive to know how to put down those phones, to be able to put pen to paper and mind to conversation, to figure out what are they going to do, which we put them in this leadership role. I believe a lot of times you have teachers who put the ceiling on top of these children, young adults, right, and children, instead of guiding them. Because I have a grandson that's 9 years old, and if I don't talk to him like an adult, he thinks that I'm not really intellectually capable of dealing with him. See, we have gotten children, and it's said biblically that they're younger and wiser, and we got to recognize
yeah.
that one. And so my whole thinking is the image that we create for them, and that image becomes for them a armor, if you will, that they are able to go out and become superheroes in the environmental changes that we know need to be done, that they know that they can do. So in those metaphors, we have to give them and empower them that responsibility. That's my point.
Brother Helene?
Yes.
How do you get beyond the disconnect? How do you connect? This is where I am. How are you going to connect when they're connected to the cell phone has become an extension of who they are? They're only concerned with the viral world.
I'm going to ask Catherine to respond how she see I could,
yes.
how I connect. Go ahead, Catherine.
I would say, to be completely honest, just through the technology, and then maybe we can bring them from, because it's not going anywhere. From what I see, it's just getting worse and worse with technology. And I would say through technology and influencers, I know for a fact that there's influencers out there that would promote these type of things, which is the truth. And I would say through technology, I don't really see any way, just because generation, and I see it every day. I am a part of it. So I really don't think there would be another way but through technology. And then bringing them from, how can I word this? That would be our hook, if that makes sense. And then from that, we would bring them to our goal and our intention, if that makes sense.
Well, it makes perfect sense to me. We're at the end of our time. We were just going to stay on for an hour tonight, unless there was an ongoing discussion that demanded more time. But I think we've gotten to a point where we can respectfully take a break. So I want to go around the table one more time, starting with you, Sister Lena, and then going back to our co-host, and then allow Catherine, if you'd like to say one closing comment, and then I'll wrap it up. So, Sister Lena, would you like to make a closing comment before we close the show?
Yeah, I realize that we were in the 21st century now. I'm a 20th century first, but I'm aware of the 21st century, the technology, and I know in the next years we won't even need any cars anymore. The cars are probably, all you have to do is order the car to come pick us up at our house or whatever. But I understand that we're there, but I'm concerned with moral issues in terms of technology and morality. I don't understand something I guess I have to pray on. I don't know how I'm going to be able to, or how we're going as a society, how we're going to be able to connect with the 21st century people. We can teach them in a classroom, but as Brother Helling said, they need guidance, and we're not even on the same level with them in terms of technology, being savvy. We can't even block them from in the classroom from on the computer in the school system. You put a block on the computer to keep them from going to pornographic sites or something that has nothing to do with what you're trying to teach them in the classroom. And they are so smart. They're such intelligent beings that they are able to bypass every system that the school board has put out there to block them from what we consider immoral sites. So I don't know. I'm still trying to figure out within myself, how can I reach this person? How can I reach these people to bring them back from that cyberspace entity that they're caught up in? And it's an entity, and it has a spirit. And I don't know if the spirit is good. I don't know. I'm rolling all this stuff around in my own head, so I can only imagine what they're going through, and they're on a higher plane in terms of they're uninhibited when it comes to using the technology that we have today. Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much, Sister Vianna. We're going to go back to you, Brother Mustafa, for closing comments, and then give Catherine one more chance if she would like to add something before we close. And then I have a piece that is very, very important in terms of the literature, since we were talking about literature in the schools. And I want to make a comment, and then I want to read this piece before we close. So, Brother Aileen, would you like to make final comments?
Yes, I would. And thank you, everyone. the core discussion or conversation needs to center around patriotic duty and what that means to sustaining our society, our culture, our humanity. That's critical. We also need to empower our young people to write. I'm not talking W-R-I-T-E, I'm talking R-I-T-H-T, right the wrongs as we or they or us write, W-R-I-T-E, and read our history to become a story of how faith really works in our life. That's critical. We also need to address all citizens' needs for equality so that no one becomes invisible citizens in our country, like during slavery, where you had people who were so depressed and repressed that they became invisible and people didn't see them as human beings. So we have to build the what or the wits of these citizens, which are us all, as we build around the ideal of what it means to be world citizens. And today I'm going to put that in one simple sentence: wealth building for life sustainability. That's it. That is our key. Wealth building for life sustainability in communities that are being gentrified out of existence. That becomes a need for patriotic duty to right the wrong in terms of writing it, making it correct, and writing it in terms of literally with the pen and paper to discuss it and all the mediums that exist in that basis. And social media becomes one of those areas that we can write, text, inform, and communicate the ideals of what it means to be a citizen or a human being, or in our case, I like to say modern-day achievers. That's my comment.
Okay, that's wonderful. Very good information and great wisdom for us to be guided by. So I'm going to go ahead and use my moderator role, you might say, to give you something that I hope will give you an enjoyable experience. I want to, since we're talking about African-American literature, I want to share as we close some very, very important African-American literature written by a lady who preceded me in age by about almost 30 years. However, she still has an impact on my thinking. One reason is because her name is the same name of my dearly beloved deceased mother. Her name was Margaret Walker. And Margaret Walker, to give you a little history about her briefly, was born in my home state in Alabama, in Birmingham, not far from Tuskegee. And she wrote a very popular and important historical novel about her family, which is named Jubilee. And she attended college. She went to Northwestern University, left Alabama, went to college at Northwestern University in Illinois. And then she went to Chicago. She worked as a writer for the federal government during the Depression. And then after that, she went to the University of Iowa. This is a girl that grew up in a rural environment. Grandparents had been, or great-grandparents had been slaves. And she grew up down in the, what we call sticks, you know, even Alabama, cities like Birmingham, we still call the black community the sticks. And so she went on to graduate school to pursue graduate study as a writer, won numerous awards, including an award from Yale University called the Younger Poets Series Award. And I want to share, I may not read all of this, it's a little lengthy piece, so I may skip some of it, but I want to read a piece that she wrote, and I could say poem, but it's more of an essay than a poem. It's entitled For My People, For My People. And I want to, before I do that, I want to ask my dear loving wife, Jackie, you're on the line listening. Did you want to share something with us before we close out?
Yes. Assalamu alaikum to all, peace be to all. And I just want to, a couple of things is to say that I really enjoy hearing this younger generation's point of view, and I believe that this younger generation is going to be just fine. You know, they are going through a lot of what we went through as we were young, and when a certain time of our lives clicks, we become more mature, and I think motherhood is one of those things that click, and I want to believe motherhood and fatherhood is going to take over that generation that has all of this mechanics in front of them. Those type of things will set the pace at that time when they do become parents, I'll say that. And I wholeheartedly believe that God is in charge of all, and he will make all okay. We're going to have those that will probably hang on to this these mechanics that a lot of the generation, the younger generation, are have some that have they have a grasp, a hold of the mechanics. But everything is going to be all right. I truly believe everything is going to be all right. But I have enjoyed this show tonight. I have enjoyed all the comments and the questions. And that's it that I have to say for tonight.
Well, thank you, thank you, thank you, sweet Jackie, my dearly beloved wife. I do want to put in a plug for my book. Brother Halim mentioned it at the beginning of the show. The name of it is Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, A Message That Will Change America. And you can, for those of you that are listening via the internet or those that are online now with us, you can order this book by sending a text message to phone number 706-399-5006. I'll say it again, 706-399-5006. Make sure you include your name, how many books you would like to order. The books are $20 each, and the shipping charge is not included in that. So depending on how many books that you order, the weight of the books will determine the shipping charge. But make sure you go ahead and not just only get one for yourself, but one or two for other members of your family so they can benefit. This is a collection of very important guidance about life that we have been able to actually extract from writings of about 10 different major writers of Black literature. So we want to share this with you. And now we're going to just read a few of the lines of this essay by Margaret Walker, and hopefully this will be something that you can benefit from. Margaret Walker says, "For my people, everywhere singing their slave songs repeatedly, dirges and their ditties, and their blues and their jubilees, praying their prayers nightly to an unknown God, bending their knees humbly to an unseen power. For my people, lending their strength to the years, to the gone years, and the now years, and the maybe years, washing, ironing, cooking, scrubbing, sowing, mending, hoeing, plowing, digging, planting, pruning, patching, dragging along, never gaining, never reaping, never knowing, and never understanding. Let a new earth rise. Let another world be born. Let a bloody peace be written in the sky. Let a second generation full of courage issue forth. Let a people loving freedom come to growth. that a beauty full of healing and a strength of final quenching be the pulsing in our spirits and in our blood. Let the martial songs be written. Let the sad songs disappear. That a race of men and women now rise and take control. And so with those words, we're closing. Now we thank all of our listeners and all of our participants in tonight's Family Room Discussion. And we ask you to join us again.
I'd like to make a comment.
Yes, of course. We won't block you. Go ahead.
I'd really like to leave with a positive note and say that the more we're masterminding we do, the more these answers will come to us, so that we can collaborate and become better. I'd like to emphasize on what my mentor was saying earlier, to let the students become leaders. And let us show you what we're made of, because I know that we're made of greatness. I know this. So thank you for the opportunity to speak, and forward to the future and many blessings.
Thank you so much, Catherine. Those were beautiful, beautiful, inspiring and closing words. And we appreciate you, and we appreciate all that you are doing and all that Dr. Ali Mustafa is doing to help you and many others to achieve your greatest potential. And to all of you who participated, Sister Baina, dear Jackie, and everyone, thank you again for joining our show tonight. And now we close on a light note, a jazz set. The title of this set is called Brandy. Thank you.